Good evening, friends, and welcome to Sleepy Tom Tales, a podcast aimed at helping you to get a good night's sleep. Do you find your mind plagued with the stresses of modern life, especially when the lights are out and you're trying to get a restful night? Does your spinning mind keep you awake? Follow my voice down the path towards a good night's rest. Listen to me tell a story that will keep your mind from wandering to your daytime problems, the ones you can't solve right now and will be easier to solve while rested. Listen to my voice and allow yourself to drift, following the twists and turns of the story, but slowly letting go and drifting into sleep. Before we get on with the show, I'd like to take a minute to thank everyone who has been listening to the show since it started back in 2019. Those people who have listened, shared, and supported the show in many wonderful and kind ways. This podcast is still around, thanks to you. I've got something interesting and new to share this week. As you listen to this, whether a few days early on Patreon or on wide release, I've just launched a new merch store in partnership with TeePublic. Now, I'm no visual artist, so the only merch I have is my logo-based stuff. But thanks to TeePublic, I can share fun artwork from other creators through my own storefront. So I can introduce people to interesting artists and support those creators while taking a small cut myself. So with the holiday season on us, consider supporting Sleepy Time Tales and other independent creators and artists. And if you have a TeePublic store yourself, drop me a link and to check it out, because I'd like to support you too. And if an artist without a TeePublic store, let me know and I can send you a referral link to help you to sign up. And other than that, of course, there are the usual ways to support the show, through the Patreon, through monthly contributions, or the tip jar, or the buy me a coffee. But I'm not going to go on about those this week. I'm just going to move on. Because another big way to help the show is simply to spread the word. A lot of people out there are struggling, so if you know someone who is as well, just tell them about Sleepy Time Tales. And make sure to let me know if you do, especially on social media. Make sure to tag me in. That's at Sleepy Time Tales on Instagram or Twitter. And of course, the music for tonight is Sweet Night and Friends by Kumiko. The music is available on their website at royaltyfreakmusic.com, and I recommend you go take a look. Thanks for taking the time. Let's get back to the show. So what exactly is Sleepy Time Tales? What is it for? What is this strange idea, this podcast, that you're supposed to fall asleep to? But the fact is, lack of sleep is a health crisis in the 21st century, and this is a podcast that is intended to help those that it can to get a restful night. Do you find yourself lying awake at night, mind spinning and emotions in turmoil with anxieties of 21st century life? Do you wake up in the middle of the night and find yourself not quite able to doze back off at 3 a.m? I'm here to help. My name is Dave, and I'm your narrator, here to help you into a restful night. Sleepy Time Tales is intended to be used as a distraction to what keeps you awake at night. Or maybe sometimes background noise or even just company. That's why I make these episodes quite long, so that I'm here for you without any pressure of the end coming. Now, as far as I'm aware, there are a couple of different ways to engage with the show. For me, the primary idea is that it gives you something to focus on, a story or an event that lets you keep your mind on a specific point, to stop it from spinning out into stress and anxieties, to focus just enough not to resist the embrace of a night's sleep. There's a second way that I think works for some people. Some people just need some kind of background noise. Maybe white noise or the wind in the trees or the sound of the ocean or just some boring dude droning on in the background. But the most important thing is that you don't try to force the sleep. Just keep a light mental grip on the thread of the story and allow the need for sleep to come for you. Now, obviously, I'm hoping that you're asleep before I get to the end of the episode, but it's important you don't feel pressurized. It may not work on the first night. It may take a few nights for you to get used to listening to my voice. Maybe my accent is strange to you. Or maybe one episode isn't long enough, at least at first. Or maybe your problem isn't so much going to sleep, Maybe your problem is waking up in the middle of the night. What I recommend is, because it's what worked for me over the years, is to let the podcast run all night. Download a bunch of episodes, enough to run through at least the whole night. Playlist them and then just let them go. That way, if you wake up at 3 a.m. and find yourself staring at the ceiling, just pop your earbuds back in if they've fallen out, or however you're listening to it, and just go back to sleep again. You can even do the same thing if you wake up just before your alarm, 60 minutes or even 30 minutes. It may seem strange, what's the point after all in getting an extra 30 minutes of sleep, but that extra 30 minutes can make a huge difference to your day. I've had people actually thank me for making this recommendation, because there's something about allowing yourself to sleep right before the alarm that's just satisfying on a whole new level. But whenever you're listening to the show, however you're listening to the show, it's very important that you try to relax into it. If you're new to it and prone to late nights lying staring at the ceiling, this may seem strange to you. So give it a chance. Because I'm here to work with you, to create a safe space, a cocoon in which you can curl up and allow nature to take its course. So if you're still with me, thank you for staying. If you're already asleep, we'll chat again soon. And of course, you aren't hearing me, except maybe in a dream. This week we return to The Time Machine by H.G. Wells. Chapter 8, Explanation. So far as I could see, all the world displayed the same exuberant richness as the Thames Valley. From every hill I climbed, I saw the same abundance of splendid buildings, endlessly varied in material and style, the same clustering thickets of evergreens, the same blossom-laden trees and tree ferns. Here and there water shone like silver, and beyond, the land rose into blue undulating hills, and so faded into the serenity of the sky. A peculiar feature which presently attracted my attention was the presence of certain circular wells, several, as it seemed to me, of a very great depth. Like the others, it was rimmed with bronze, curiously wrought and protected by a little cupola from the rain. Sitting by the side of these wells and peering down into the shafted darkness, I could see no gleam of water. Nor could I start any reflection with a lighted match. But in all of them I heard a certain sound, a thud, 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 like the beating of some big engine. And I discovered, from the flaring of my matches, that a steady current of air sent down the shafts. Further, I threw a scrap of paper into the throat of one, and instead of fluttering slowly down, it was at once sucked swiftly out of sight. After a time, too, I came to connect these wells with tall towers standing here and there upon the slopes, for above them there was often just such a flicker in the air as one sees on a hot day above a sun-scorched beach. Putting things together, I reached a strong suggestion of an extensive system of subterranean ventilation, whose true import it was difficult to imagine. I was at first inclined to associate it with the sanitary apparatus of these people. It was an obvious conclusion, but it was absolutely wrong. And here I must admit that I learned very little of drains and bells and modes of conveyance and the like conveniences during my time in this real future. In some of these visions of utopias and coming times which I have read, there is a vast amount of detail about building and social arrangements and so forth. But while such details are easy enough to obtain when the whole world is contained in one's imagination, they are altogether inaccessible to a real traveller amid such realities as are found here. Conceive the tale of London which someone fresh from Central Africa would take back home. What would he know of railway companies, of social movements, of telephone and telegraph wires, of the parcels delivery company and postal orders and the like. Yet we at least should be willing enough to explain these things to him. And even of what he knew, how much could he make his untravelled friend either apprehend or believe? Then how narrow that gap, and how wide the interval between myself and these of the Golden Age. I was sensible of much which was unseen and which contributed to my comfort, but save for a general impression of automatic organization, I fear I can convey very little of the difference to your mind. In the metal of sepulture, for instance, I could see no signs of crematoria or anything suggestive of tombs. But it occurred to me that possibly there might be cemeteries or crematoria somewhere beyond the range of my explorings. This, again, was a question I deliberately put to myself, and my curiosity was at first entirely defeated upon the point. The thing puzzled me, and I was led to make a further remark, which puzzled still more, that aged and infirm among this people there were none. I must confess that my satisfaction with my first theories of an automatic civilization and a decadent humanity did not long endure. Yet I could think of no other. Let me put my difficulties. The several big palaces I had explored were mere living places. Great dining halls and sleeping apartments. I could find no machinery, no appliances of any kind. Yet these people were clothed in pleasant fabrics that must at times need renewal, and their sandals, though undecorated, were fairly complex specimens of metalwork. Somehow such things must be made, and the little people displayed no vestige of a creative tendency. There were no shops, no workshops, no sign of importations among them. They spent all their time in playing gently, in bathing in the river, in making love in a half-playful fashion, in eating fruit and sleeping. I could not see how things were kept going. Then again, about the time machine, something, I knew not what, had taken it into the hollow pedestal of the White Sphinx. Why? For the life of me, I could not imagine. Those waterless wells too, those flickering pillars. I felt I lacked a clue. I felt, how shall I put it? Suppose you found an inscription with sentences here and there in excellent plain English and interpolated therewith, others made up of words, of letters even, absolutely unknown to you. Well, on the third day of my visit, that was how the world of 802,701 presented itself to me. That day too I made a friend, of a sort. It happened that, as I was watching, some of the little people bathed in a shallow. One of them was seized with cramp and began drifting downstream. The main current ran rather swiftly, but not too strongly for even a moderate swimmer. It will give you an idea, therefore, of the strange deficiency in these creatures, when I tell you that none made the slightest attempt to rescue the weakly crying little thing, which was drowning before their eyes. When I realized this, I hurriedly slipped off my clothes and, wading in at a point lower down, I caught the poor mite and drew her safe to land. A little rubbing of the limbs soon brought her round, and I had the satisfaction of seeing she was all right before I left her. I'd got to such a low estimate of her kind that I did not expect any gratitude from her. In that, however, I was wrong. This happened in the morning. In the afternoon, I met my little woman, as I believe it was, as I was returning towards my centre from an exploration. And she received me with cries of delight and presented me with a big garland of flowers, evidently made for me and me alone. The thing took my imagination. Very possibly I'd been feeling desolate, At any rate, I did my best to display my appreciation of the gift. We were soon seated together in a little stone arbor, engaged in conversation, chiefly of smiles. The creature's friendliness affected me exactly as a child's might have done. We passed each other flowers and she kissed my hands. I did the same to hers. Then I tried talk and found that her name was Weena, which, though I didn't know what it meant, somehow seemed appropriate enough. That was the beginning of a queer friendship which lasted a week and ended, as I will tell you. She was exactly like a child. She wanted to be with me always. She tried to follow me everywhere, and on my next journey out and about, it went to my heart to tire her down and leave her at last, exhausted, and calling after me rather plaintively. But the problems of the world had to be mastered. I had not, I said to myself, come into the future to carry on a miniature flirtation. Yet her distress when I left her was very great. Her expostulations at the parting were sometimes frantic. And I think, altogether, I had as much trouble as comfort from her devotion. Nevertheless, she was, somehow, a very great comfort. I thought it was mere childish affection that made her cling to me. Until it was too late, I did not clearly know what I inflicted upon her when I left her. Nor, until it was too late, did I clearly understand what she was to me. For, by merely seeming fond of me and showing in her weak, futile way that she cared for me, the little doll of a creature presently gave my return to the neighborhood of the White Sphinx almost a feeling of coming home. And I would watch for her tiny figure of white and gold as soon as I came over the hill. It was from her, too, that I learned that fear had not yet left the world. She was fearless enough in the daylight, and she had the oldest confidences in me. For once in a foolish moment, I made threatening grimaces at her, and she simply laughed at them. But she dreaded the dark, dreaded shadows, dreaded black things. Darkness to her was the one thing dreadful. It was a singularly passionate emotion, and it set me thinking and observing. I discovered then, among other things, that these little people gathered into the great houses after dark and slept in droves. To enter upon them without a light was to put them into a tumult of apprehension. I never found one out of doors or one sleeping alone within doors after dark. Yet I was still such a blockhead that I missed the lesson of that fear, and in spite of Weena's distress, I insisted upon sleeping away from these slumbering multitudes. It troubled her greatly, but in the end her odd affection for me triumphed, and for 5 of the nights of our acquaintance, including the last night of all, she slept with her head pillowed on my arm. But my story slips away from me as I speak of her. It must have been the night before her rescue that I was awakened about dawn. I had been restless, dreaming most disagreeably that I was drowned, and that sea anemones were feeling over my face with their soft pulps. I woke with a start and with an odd fancy that some greyish animal had just rushed out of the chamber. I tried to get to sleep again, but I felt restless and uncomfortable. It was that dim grey hour when things are just creeping out of darkness, when everything is colourless and clear-cut, and yet unreal. I got up and went down into the great hall, and so out upon the flagstones in front of the palace. I thought I would make a virtue of necessity and see the sunrise. The moon was setting, and the dying moonlight and the first pallor of dawn were mingled in a ghastly half-light. The bushes were inky black, the ground a somber grey, the sky colourless and cheerless, and up the hill I thought I could see ghosts. three several times as I scanned the slope bustle white figures. Twice I fancied I saw a solitary white ape-like creature running rather quickly up the hill. And once near the ruins, I saw a leash of them carrying some dark body. They moved hastily. I did not see what became of them. It seemed that they vanished among the bushes. The dawn was still indistinct, you must understand. I was feeling that chill, uncertain early morning feeling you may have known. I doubted my eyes. As the eastern sky grew brighter and the light of the day came on, and its vivid colouring returned upon the world once more, I scanned the view keenly. But I saw no vestige of my white figures. They were mere creatures of the half-light. They must have been ghosts, I said. I wonder whence they dated. For a queer notion of Grant Allen's came into my head and amused me. If each generation die and leave ghosts, he argued, the world at last will get overcrowded with them. On that theory, they would have grown innumerable some 800,000 years hence, and it was no great wonder to see four at once. But the jest was unsatisfying, and I was thinking of these figures all the morning, until Weena's rescue drove them out of my head. I associated them in some indefinite way with the white animal I had startled in my first passionate search for the time machine. But Weena was a pleasant substitute. Yet all the same, they were soon destined to take far deadlier possession of my mind. I think I have said how much hotter than our own was the weather of this golden age. I cannot account for it. It may be that the sun was hotter, or the earth nearer the sun. It is usual to assume that the sun will go on cooling steadily in the future. But people, unfamiliar with such speculations, as those of the younger Darwin, forget that the planets must ultimately fall back, one by one, into the parent body. As these catastrophes occur, the sun will blaze with renewed energy. And it may be that some inner planet had suffered this fate. Whatever the reason, the fact remains that the sun was very much hotter than we know it. Well, one very hot morning, my fourth, I think, as I was seeking shelter from the heat and glare in a colossal ruin near the great house where I slept and fed, there happened the strange thing. Clambering among these heaps of masonry, I found a narrow gallery whose end and side windows were blocked by fallen masses of stone. By contrast with the brilliancy outside, it seemed at first impenetrably dark to me. I entered it groping, for the change from light to blackness made spots of colour swim before me. Suddenly I halted spellbound. A pair of eyes, luminous by reflection against the daylight without, was watching me out of the darkness. The old instinctive dread of wild beasts came upon me. I clenched my hands and steadfastly looked into the glaring eyeballs. I was afraid to turn. Then the thought of the absolute security in which humanity appeared to be living came to my mind. And then I remembered that strange terror of the dark. Overcoming my fear to some extent, I advanced a step and spoke. I will admit that my voice was harsh and ill-controlled. I put out my hand and touched something soft. At once the eyes darted sideways and something white ran past me. I turned with my heart in my mouth and saw a queer little ape-like creature, its head held down in a peculiar manner, running across the sunlit space behind me. It blundered against a block of granite and staggered aside, and in a moment was hidden in a black shadow beneath another pile of ruined masonry. My impression of it is, of course, imperfect, but I know it was a dull white, and had strange, large, greyish-red eyes. Also that there was flaxen hair on its head and down its back, But, as I say, it went too fast for me to see distinctly. I cannot even say whether it ran on all fours or only with its forearms held very low. After an instant's pause, I followed it into the second heap of ruins. I could not find it at first, but after a time in the profound obscurity, I came upon one of those round well-like openings of which I have told you, half closed by a fallen pillar. A sudden thought came to me. Could this thing have vanished down the shaft? I lit a match, and looking down, I saw a small, white, moving creature, with large, bright eyes, which regarded me steadfastly as it retreated. It made me shudder. It was so like a human spider. It was clambering down the wall, and now I saw for the first time a number of metal foot and hand rests forming a kind of ladder down the shaft. Then the light burned my fingers and fell out of my hand, going out as it dropped. And when I had lit another, the little monster had disappeared. I do not know how long I sat peering down that well. It was not for some time that I could succeed in persuading myself that the thing I had seen was human. But gradually the truth dawned on me. That man had not remained one species, but had differentiated into two distinct animals. That my graceful children of the upper world were not the sole descendants of our generation, but that this bleached, obscene, nocturnal thing which had flashed before me was also heir to all the ages. I thought of the flickering pillars and of my theory of an underground ventilation. I began to suspect the true import. And what, I wondered, was this lemur doing in my scheme of a perfectly balanced organization? How was it related to the indolent serenity of the beautiful overworlders? And what was hidden down there, at the foot of that shaft? I sat upon the edge of the well, telling myself that, at any rate, there was nothing to fear, and that I must descend for the solution to my difficulties. And withal I was absolutely afraid to go. As I hesitated, two of the beautiful upper world people came running in their amorous sport across the daylight in the shadow. The male pursued the female, flinging flowers at her as he ran. They seemed distressed to find me, my arm against the overturned pillar, peering down the well. Apparently it was considered bad form to remark these apertures, for when I pointed to this one and tried to frame a question about it in their tongue, they were still more visibly distressed and turned away. But they were interested in my matches, and I struck some to amuse them. I tried them again about the well, and again I failed. So presently I left them, meaning to go back to Weena and see what I could get from her. But my mind was already in revolution. My guesses and impressions were slipping and sliding to a new adjustment. I had now a clue to the import of these wells, to the ventilating towers, to the mystery of the ghosts, to say nothing of a hint at the meaning of the bronze gates and the fate of the time machine. And very vaguely there came a suggestion towards the solution of the economic problem that had puzzled me. Here was the new view. Plainly, this second species of man was subterranean. There were three circumstances in particular which made me think that its rare emergence above ground was the outcome of a long-continued underground habit. In the first place, there was the bleached look common in most animals that live largely in the dark. The white fish of the Kentucky caves, for instance. Then those large eyes with that capacity for reflecting light are a common feature of nocturnal things. Witness the owl and the cat. And last of all, that evident confusion in the sunshine. That hasty yet fumbling awkward flight towards dark shadow. And the peculiar carriage of the head while in the light. All reinforced the theory of an extreme sensitiveness of the retina. Beneath my feet, then, the earth must be tunneled enormously, and those tunnelings were the habitat of the new race. The presence of ventilating shafts and wells along the hill slopes, everywhere in fact, except along the river valley, showed how universal were its ramifications. What so natural then as to assume that it was in this artificial underworld that such work as was necessary to the comfort of the daylight race was done? The notion was so plausible that I at once accepted it, and then went on to assume the how of the splitting of the human species. I dare say you'll anticipate the shape of my theory, though for myself I very soon felt that it was far short of the truth. At first, proceeding from the problems of our own age, it seemed clear as daylight to me that the gradual widening of the present merely temporary and social difference between the capitalist and the labourer was the key to the whole position. No doubt it will seem grotesque enough to you, and wildly incredible. And yet even now there are existing circumstances to point that way. There is a tendency to utilize underground space for the less ornamental purposes of civilization. There is the Metropolitan Railway in London, for instance. There are new electric railways, there are subways, there are underground workrooms and restaurants, and they increase and multiply. Evidently, I thought this tendency had increased till industry had gradually lost its birthright in the sky. I mean that it had gone deeper and deeper into larger and ever larger underground factories, spending a still increasing amount of its time therein till the end. Even now, does not an East End worker live in such artificial conditions as practically to be cut off from the natural surface of the earth? Again, the exclusive tendency of richer people, due no doubt to the increased refinement of their education and the widening gulf between them and the rude violence of the poor, is already leading to the closing in their interest of considerable portions of the surface of the land. About London, for instance, past half the prettier country is shut in against intrusion, and this same widening gulf, which is due to the length and expense of the higher educational process, and the increased facilities for and temptations towards refined habits on the part of the rich, will make the exchange between class and class, that promotion by intermarriage which at present retards the splitting of our species along lines of social stratification, less and less frequent. So in the end, above ground, you will have the haves, pursuing pleasure and comfort and beauty, and below ground, the have-nots, the workers getting continually adapted to the conditions of their labour. Once they were there, they would no doubt have to pay rent, and not a little of it, for the ventilation of their caverns, and if they refused, they would starve or be suffocated for arrears. Such of them as were so constituted as to be miserable and rebellious would die. And in the end, the balance being permanent, the survivors would become as well adapted to the conditions of underground life, and as happy in their way as the overworld people were to theirs. As it seemed to me, the refined beauty and the etiolated pallor followed naturally enough. The great triumph of humanity I had dreamed of took a different shape in my mind. It had been no such triumph of moral education and general cooperation as I had imagined. Instead, I saw a real aristocracy, armed with a perfected science and working to a logical conclusion the industrial system of today. Its triumph had not been simply a triumph over nature, but a triumph over nature and the fellow man. This, I must warn you, was my theory at the time. I had no convenient cicerone in the pattern of utopian books. My explanation may be absolutely wrong. I still think it is the most plausible one. But even on this supposition, the balanced civilization that was at last attained must have long since passed its zenith and was now far fallen into decay. The too perfect security of the overworlders had led them to a slow movement of degeneration, to general dwindling in size, strength, and intelligence. That I could see clearly enough already. What had happened to the undergrounders I did not yet suspect. But from what I have seen of the Morlocks, that, by the by, was the name which these creatures were called, I could imagine that the modification of the human type was even far more profound than among the Eloi, the beautiful race that I already knew. Then came troublesome doubts. Why had the Morlocks taken my time machine? For I felt sure it was they who had taken it. Why, too, if the Eloi were masters, could they not restore the machine to me? And why were they so terribly afraid of the dark? I proceeded, as I have said, to question Weena about this underworld, but here again I was disappointed. At first she would not understand my questions, and presently she refused to answer them. She shivered as though the topic was unendurable, and when I pressed her, perhaps a little harshly, she burst into tears. They were the only tears, except my own, I ever saw in the Golden Age. And when I saw them, I ceased abruptly to trouble about the Morlocks, and was only concerned in banishing these signs of her human inheritance from Weena's eyes. And very soon she was smiling and clapping her hands while I solemnly burned a match. Chapter 9. The Morlocks. It may seem odd to you, but it was 2 days before I could follow up the newfound clue in what was manifestly the proper way. I felt a peculiar shrinking from these pallid bodies. They were just the half-bleached colour of the worms and things one sees preserved in spirit in a zoological museum. They were filthily cold to the touch. Probably my shrinking was largely due to the empathetic influence of the Eloi, whose disgust of the Morlocks I now began to appreciate. The next night I did not sleep well. Probably my health was a little disordered. I was oppressed with perplexity and doubt. Once or twice I had a feeling of intense fear for which I could perceive no definite reason. I remember creeping noiselessly into the great hall where the little people were sleeping in the moonlight. That night Weena was among them, and feeling reassured by their presence. It occurred to me even then that in the course of a few days the moon must pass through its last quarter and the nights grow dark, when the appearances of these unpleasant creatures from below, these whitened lemurs, this new vermin that had replaced the old, might be more abundant. And on both these days I had the restless feeling of one who shirks an inevitable duty. I felt assured that the time machine was only to be recovered by boldly penetrating these mysteries of underground. Yet I could not face the mystery. If only I'd had a companion, it would have been different. But I was so horribly alone. And even to clamber down into the darkness of the well appalled me. I don't know if you'll understand my feeling, but I never quite felt safe at my back. It was this restlessness, this insecurity perhaps, that drove me further and further afield in my exploring expeditions. Going to the southwestward towards the rising country that is now called Combe Wood, I observed far off, in the direction of 19th century Banstead, a vast green structure, different in character from any I had hitherto seen. It was larger than the largest of the palaces or ruins I knew, and the facade had an Asian look, the face of it having the luster as well as the pale green tint, a kind of bluish green of a certain type of Chinese porcelain. This difference in aspect suggested a difference in use, and I was minded to push on and explore. But the day was growing late and I had come upon the site of the place after a long and tiring circuit. so I resolved to hold over the adventure for the following day. And I returned to the welcome and the caresses of little Weena. But next morning I perceived clearly enough that my curiosity regarding the Palace of Green Porcelain was a piece of self-deception, to enable me to shirk, by another day, an experience I dreaded. I resolved I would make the descent without further waste of time, and started out in the early morning towards a well, near the ruins of granite and aluminium. Little Weena ran with me. She danced beside me to the well, but when she saw me lean over the mouth and look downward, she seemed strangely disconcerted. "Goodbye, little Weena," I said, kissing her, and then putting her down. I began to feel over the parapet for the climbing hooks. Rather hastily, I may as well confess, for I feared my courage might leak away. At first she watched me in amazement. Then she gave a most piteous cry, and running to me, she began to pull at me with her little hands. I think her opposition nerved me rather to proceed. I shook her off, perhaps a little roughly, and in another moment I was in the throat of the well. I saw her agonized face over the parapet and smiled to reassure her. Then I had to look down at the unstable hooks to which I clung. I had to clamber down a shaft of perhaps 200 yards. The descent was effected by means of metallic bars projecting from the sides of the well, and these being adapted to the needs of a creature much smaller and lighter than myself, I was speedily cramped and fatigued by the descent. And not simply fatigued. One of the bars bent suddenly under my weight and almost swung me off into the blackness beneath. For a moment I hung by one hand, and after that experience I did not dare to rest again. Though my arms and back were presently acutely painful, I went on clambering down the sheer descent with as quick a motion as possible. Glancing upward, I saw the aperture, a small blue disk in which a star was visible, while little Weena's head showed as a round black projection. The thudding sound of a machine below grew louder and more oppressive. Everything save that little disk above was profoundly dark, and when I looked up again, Weena had disappeared. I was in an agony of discomfort, at some thought of trying to go up the shaft again and leave the underworld alone. But even while I turned this over in my mind, I continued to descend. At last, with intense relief, I saw dimly coming up, a foot to the right of me, a slender loophole in the wall. Swinging myself in, I found it was the aperture of a narrow horizontal tunnel in which I could lie down and rest. It was not too soon. My arms ached, my back was cramped, and I was trembling with a prolonged terror of a fall. Besides this, the unbroken darkness had had a distressing effect upon my eyes. The air was full of the throb and hum of machinery pumping air down the shaft. I do not know how long I lay. I was aroused by a soft hand touching my face. Starting up in the darkness, I snatched at my matches and, hastily striking one, I saw three stooping white creatures similar to the one I had seen above ground in the ruin, hastily retreating before the light. Living as they did in what appeared to me impenetrable darkness, their eyes were abnormally large and sensitive, just as are the pupils of the abysmal fishes, and they reflected the light in the same way. I have no doubt they could see me in that rayless obscurity, and they did not seem to have any fear of me apart from the light. But so soon as I struck a match in order to see them, they fled incontinently, vanishing into the dark gutters and tunnels from which their eyes glared at me in the strangest fashion. And I think I'm going to leave it there tonight. This is obviously an old classic, so if you'd like to pick up where we're leaving off and carry on with the story, you can, as always, find it on Project Gutenberg at the link in the show notes. Thanks again for joining me on this episode of Sleepy Time Tales, the podcast designed around a bedtime story to help you to get a restful night. New episodes were released every Sunday night to give you something fresh to help you rest in a new week. But make sure to subscribe in whatever service you use so that you get your new episodes whenever they come out. A reminder that the music for tonight is Sweet Night and Friends by Kumiku. Check out more of their work on their website, which you'll find linked in the show notes. Good night, and sweet dreams.